When Chef Gregory Gourdet got sober, he made the decision to go all in on health and fitness. He did yoga, went to the gym regularly, took up running, got into CrossFit. He also decided to change the way he ate. In his words, quote, "No vegetables and fruits were off limits, but I started to focus more on the dark, sexy, nutrient-dense ones, beets, carrots, sweet potatoes, and leafy greens." His new cookbook is called Everyone's Table, Global Recipes for Modern Health, co-written by J.J. Good. Gourdet focuses on health-friendly recipes inspired by his Haitian heritage, as well as his culinary education and the years he spent working in professional kitchens. He might also be recognizable to you as a two-time contestant and guest judge on Top Chef. Everyone's Table, Global Recipes for Modern Health is out now, and you can go to our website to check out one of these delicious recipes, slow-cooked salmon with tamale sauce. And Gregory Gourdet has a virtual event with Books Are Magic in conversation with Gail Simmons tonight at 7, and he is with us now. Welcome, Gregory.
Thank you so much. How are you?
I'm doing great. You know, your pre-professional life is really interesting. So I want to start when you were a kid. Your parents
Sure.
were Haitian immigrants who moved to Queens. And they sent you to live with your grandparents in Haiti when you were about 4 so your parents could focus on building a life here, which meant working a lot. And also so you could experience Haiti. When you think about your time with family in Haiti, what role did food play in your life and in your family's life?
Sure. Well, in the traditional Haitian household, you know, it's especially in Haiti where meals are pretty important and they're extremely familial, and it's a lot of everyone kind of sitting down and having a meal together. You know, elders come home for lunch and people would stop working and, you know, breakfast would be served and lunch was a full sit-down meal experience, as was dinner. So, you know, I would shuttle back and forth between Haiti and America a little bit. You know, we would summer there as we got older with our family. But, you know, we always had food on the table. It was a huge part of our kind of upbringing. And if my mother wasn't cooking or, you know, a lot of our relatives in Haiti have cooks, that's kind of like the way culture is over there. So there's always someone cooking. And even in back in the States in America, growing up in Queens, oftentimes, you know, we were cared for by our aunts or grandmothers visiting because my parents worked so much to provide for us. So there was always, you know, a pot of rice, you know, some beans, some chicken stewing. So there's always food around.
You describe yourself as a latecomer to the cooking game. You're studying wildlife biology at the University of Montana at Missoula. Okay, what was the original plan and when did you change plans?
Yes. So it's the classic story of, you know, the immigrant parents and, you know, they want to ensure that you're going to be the best and, you know, choose a great successful career. And I had always thought that, you know, I would be a pediatrician, actually. You know, ever since I was a very young child, I just always thought I wanted to be a pediatrician. Both my parents worked in the medical field. So it was just something that should have seemed natural. But, you know, I quickly realized my passion wasn't there, and the chemistry and the biology of it kind of seemed to go over my head. So I did want to stay in the same general field, so I moved out to Montana and studied wildlife biology. And that, too, seemed a little bit too extreme for me, but it was actually there that I was living on my own for the first time and, you know, having to pay my own rent and having to feed myself for the first time. So I started cooking to feed myself, and that kind of turned into cooking for friends over the holidays, having small potlucks and dinner parties, and that's where I discovered my passion. The funny thing about all of that, however, is that, you know, there's so much chemistry and biology, environmentalism in food and in farming, and so it actually makes a lot of sense that my path led me to what I'm doing today.
My guest is Gregory Gourdet. The name of his new cookbook is Everyone's Table, Global Recipes for Modern Health. So once you started to have some success as a food professional, you're very candid about drugs and alcohol coming into the picture. When you look back at that time in your life, what do you think was the connection between drug use and being a professional in this industry?
Sure. You know, I think for me, it just started out as an escape experience. Growing up in Queens with very traditional parents, very, you know, upright professional parents, you know, who, you know, had to, you know, conform in a lot of ways to fit into American society. You know, they have thick accents, and, you know, for them it was all about just working hard and looking respectable and being proper. And I think to counterbalance that, you know, my experimenting with drugs kind of led me down a little bit of darker of a rabbit hole than I probably should have been in. But, you know, that really was part of the experimentation, you know, like formative years, adolescence and growing up. But as I got older, you know, it got far darker. And when you work in a restaurant and you're working in New York City, a city that never sleeps, and, you know, the bar is open till 4 a.m., that, you know, it was the early aughts, you know, during the worst of my addiction, and, you know, the clubs are open for days, it really became a pretty nasty habit. You know, when you work for 12 hours straight and you're pushing yourself and you're working with the best ingredients in the world, you have a lot of pressure. You put a lot of pressure on yourself. And to combat that, you know, it's all about going out. It's kind of commiserating with fellow peers. And I just got really sucked into the New York City nightlife. I have a very addictive personality, which kept me dark in my addiction. And, you know, from year one to year seven, because I had a 7-year battle with drugs and alcohol, things just got really, really worse. And as you can imagine, if you're battering at your body for that long, how badly that can get.
Once you decided to make a change and you got sober, you sort of went all in. You started to exercise, and you also decided to change your diet, which is interesting given what you do for a living. Why did you decide to change your diet? What went into that decision?
Sure. You know, for me, getting sober a little bit later in life, I was about 33 years old when I got sober, and I just really had enough, and I really looked in the mirror and I told myself I wanted different things in life. I wanted to be a better person. I wanted to focus on my career, and I just wanted to, you know, try to push myself as much as possible in positive ways. So I had kind of grown tired of the standard gym. CrossFit was really big around that time. It was about 13 years ago. So I joined the CrossFit gym, and that oftentimes went hand in hand with the paleo diet. And, you know, the paleo diet kind of inspires us to eat how we supposedly did during the Paleolithic era, where we were hunters and gatherers. And I just thought it was very interesting and very cool. And it was all about eating, you know, well-sourced meats, lots of plants, lots of nuts and seeds, giving up processed foods, giving up dairy and gluten. And I just went all in. I was at a place in my life where I was open for change and open to accepting new experiences. And I just went for it, and I went off dairy and gluten for years each, and I felt far better. I kind of switched out my mindset of how processed foods shouldn't play a part of my diet, how, you know, eating nutrient-dense foods are extremely important, and how, you know, while Mother Nature does provide all these amazing things that grow out of the ground that do provide nutrients, a lot of them have anti-nutrients, a lot of them are inflammatory. A lot of them cause gastrointestinal issues. So just avoiding those and eating as much of the good stuff as I wanted.
So if I go into your pantry, what are some of the items that I will see, and what are some of the items that I won't see?
I love this question. You know, for me, you're always going to see a great big bottle of extra virgin olive oil. It's such a great, heart healthy oil. One of my other favorite oils is avocado oil. And oftentimes we use grapeseed oil for sauteing or for frying, but grapeseed oil is actually produced by a very harsh chemical process, whereas avocado oil is literally just made from squeezing the flesh of the avocado. So it's kind of knowing like a little bit of how things are created, how things are made, and kind of just going with the good stuff.
My guest is Chef Gregory Gourdet. The name of his new cookbook is Everyone's Table, Global Recipes for Modern Health. Let's talk about some recipes. Asparagus is in season. You have a creamy asparagus salad with sunflower seed. I'm going to let you say it.
Furikake.
There you go. what is this? This sounds delicious.
Yes, this is actually, I love that salad, and it's a really fun way to prepare asparagus. Asparagus just really gets lightly sauteed really, really quickly for almost just like a minute or two until it's bright green and crunchy. And furikake is a Japanese seasoning. It's oftentimes served right on top of rice. It has like sesame seeds and crushed up nori. Sometimes it has a little bit of fish flakes. Sometimes it has a little Japanese pepper and a little bit of chili. But it's just like a really fun, crunchy sprinkle on seasoning. And in the recipe, we make one with sunflower seeds and toasted garlic and chilies and nori. And it becomes this crunchy, crispy, fun topping that you sprinkle all over the salad. And the salad is actually dressed with a sunflower seed dressing. So you take some sunflower seeds, some rice vinegar, a little bit of olive oil, blend that up, and you get this creamy asparagus. It's enhanced with avocado and cucumbers. So you have this beautiful green salad that has crunch, that has texture, that has good fats, and then you have this beautiful furikake crunchy seasoning on top.
You were kind enough to let us post one of your recipes on our website, slow-cooked salmon with timalis sauce. All right, the timalis sauce.
Yes.
Tell us about its origins.
Absolutely. One of my favorite parts of the book is, while it is a health-focused book, you know, I have always been influenced by global cuisines, from, you know, working in French restaurants to working in Pan-Asian restaurants to tapping into my own heritage. So, you know, the book definitely represents a global pantry and introduces lots of different flavors from all around the world. And timalis is one of these amazing sauces with a really fantastic story. It's a beautiful marinade of onions and habanero and thyme and lime juice and vinegar. And you slowly cook the onions so they're just a little bit crunchy. So they're really sour and tart and crunchy. It's like really the perfect complement to a really fatty piece of salmon. And I learned how to cook salmon recently at Jean Georges, and I love this recipe for its simplicity. It's a big old slab of salmon. You slather it with olive oil, sprinkle it with salt, and slowly bake it in the oven until it's super flaky and tender. But the timalis sauce is the folklore behind it is there are some friends in Haiti, and Buki is one of them, and he continually would come over to Timalis's house and eat all his food. So Timalis thought by making something really funky and sour and spicy, he would get Buki to stop coming over. But Buki actually screamed all over how delicious the Timalis sauce was. And that's the story behind that sauce.
I want to roll on back to how you cook the salmon, because you write, people, you're overcooking your salmon. What is the best way to slow cook salmon?
Yes. So we start with a low oven. I believe it's 350 in the book. It might be 325 or 300, but you start with a very low oven. You just, you know, the salmon is cooked whole. You know, you can purchase a 1 to 2 pound piece, and you simply season it with salt and cover with a couple tablespoons of olive oil and just bake it in the oven. And I highly encourage people to use thermometers if they're kind of figuring out how to cook various types of proteins, and so you can kind of look at it and feel it and feel comfortable that it's cooked. But the perfect time to pull salmon out of the oven is when you have the ever slightest, tiniest white beads coming up from the top of the thickest part of the salmon. And that means that it has been heated through, and that little white is a little bit of protein that's coming through. But when you see that, just the tiniest white beads, and when your salmon goes from, say, an orangish hue to more of a kind of dustier pink, that's when your salmon's ready. You definitely don't want your salmon to be like really white or really bright, because that means it's getting overcooked.
And I just looked it up. It's 300, by the way. 300 for
Thank
the salmon.
You.
My guest is Chef Gregory Gourdet. The name of the book is Everyone's Table, Global Recipes for Modern Health. I want to talk about this, your Haitian-spiced pineapple upside-down cake.
Yes.
I feel like all grandmas of color make some sort of upside-down cake. Mine did. And this one's interesting because you have the paleo-friendly flour. You have in here cinnamon, coconut sugar, virgin coconut oil, coconut milk, vanilla, almond for the cake. What inspired this recipe? Who inspired this?
Absolutely. Yeah, I love this recipe. It's one of my favorite recipes. I've actually served it in restaurants for the last couple of years. But Haitian pineapple upside-down cake is a very iconic and classic Haitian dessert. It's a flour-based cake. It's seasoned with the same spices. It has cinnamon. It has star anise, it has tons of vanilla, it has almond extract and lime zest. So again, you know, that's really just going to make a beautiful cake when you contrast that with and complement that with like that beautiful pineapple that gets cooked with sugar and some more of those spices. So for my version, you know, the whole book is based on alternative ingredients. It's gluten-free, it's dairy-free, and it's refined sugar-free. So I think this recipe really represents one of the dishes that kind of symbolize the entire book. It's a little bit on the more advanced side of the book, but it's definitely not hard to make. And we start with a flour blend, which features coconut flour, almond flour, and tapioca flour. And this is a really great flour that you can use to create perfect texture, perfect crumb. You can make muffins. You can make all different types of cakes with this flour. I worked really hard, and I think a lot of people will not even know it's gluten-free, which is the best part. And we sub out for, you know, brown sugar. We use coconut sugar and maple syrup, and both are lower glycemic, which means your body doesn't process them as quickly. They take slower to process, so it's a little bit healthier and better for your heart. And they actually do carry a little bit of nutrients and antioxidants, but again, you know, sugar in general is not great for you, but switching out for these more natural sugar options lets you enjoy a treat. You know, I believe we should be able to enjoy the things that we love, and why not have a piece of cake every now and then? And this one's made with a little bit better ingredients.
My guest is Chef Gregory Gourdet. The name of his cook is Everyone's Table, Global Recipes for Modern Health. I know you had plans to open a restaurant. They were sidelined by the pandemic. There's so much that had happened in the past year. We've had all kinds of reckonings in every industry up and down the scale, and of course, including in hospitality. You worked at a place, you were an executive chef where there had been some reports of abusive treatment and behavior. And as you go forward, as you think, not by you, but as you go forward, what are you thinking? What is one thing that could be done in your industry? I mean, pie in the sky it, that would make a big difference.
Sure.
Make it fair and equitable for people.
Absolutely. You know, this is a very important topic. It's something I think about every single day. You know, what happened last year, I think with the racial reckoning that happened in our country, it inspired a lot of other areas, you know, of opportunity for us to really dive into and look to and to kind of break these systems. And a lot of industry workers across the country raised their voices and said that they felt that they were treated unfairly. I was, you know, very much caught up in some accusations as well. And, you know, I think the first thing is conversation. I think it's really important that we are able to have open and honest conversations face-to-face about these, you know, these challenges, so we can truly understand, you know, how we can proceed to make everyone feel good in the workplace. And for me, you know, I wanted to dive in right away. I opened up my restaurant kind of delayed because of COVID, but I did do a pop-up over the winter, and we did open in December at the height of the pandemic, and we actually just closed our doors at the end of last month. But I 100% wanted to just start working on this right away. And for me, what I heard most is, you know, a lot of Women X, felt that they were, you know, not paid equally. They felt that opportunities of leadership weren't there for them. They felt there wasn't equity in payment. So, you know, it was really important to me that, you know, my team could highlight and be led by Women X. And we were able to maintain a staff of 90% Women X. It was really important to me that representation was part of the story of the restaurant and is part of the story of the pop-up. So we were able to, you know, hire a team which was 90% POC. So, I think there's a huge discrepancy between wages between front of the house and back of the house, between the servers and the cooks. So I took a step forward to pay everyone equally throughout the restaurant and to share tips equally between front and the back of the house. We were able to promote 3 women of color into management positions during our 5-month run. So So it was really, really a good experiment. And I know that having some of these systems under my belt now and, you know, working on these relationships with these people, I hopefully, you know, will have them be, you know, my leadership team when I do open up my restaurant. And we know that we have a much stronger footing on how we can build restaurants to be more equitable, to have more women-ex leadership, and to create spaces where everyone feels good.
The name of the cookbook is Everyone's Table, Global Recipes for Modern Health. I've been speaking with Chef Gregory Gourdet. Chef, thanks for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.